Hello, this is Dean Kernut, and welcome to the Alpha Exchange, where we explore topics in financial markets associated with managing risk, generating return, and the deployment of capital in the alternative investment industry. Cutting his teeth on the acclaimed mortgage trading desk at Salomon Brothers in the 90s, Troy Dixon gained an early appreciation for the speed and degree to which market liquidity can turn. Now the CIO of Hollis Park Partners, a firm he founded in 2013, Troy shares the perspectives gathered in managing complex trading risks over more than two decades in markets. We talk about his time at Deutsche Bank, where he ran the RMBS trading unit, and the intense pressure to compete in the pre-crisis period for profitability in each aspect of the mortgage lifecycle. Contemplating the asset price wreckage in the aftermath of the housing crash, Troy recounts the challenges in balancing the competing interests of providing market-making services for the firm's client base while risk managing a volatile book of prop exposures. Next, we discuss Troy's founding of Hollis Park and the path that he has sought to provide for other professionals of color in the financial industry. In thinking back on the heavy lift he undertook, Troy said, "I was naive about a lot of things, but the core thesis of it was to lay the framework for people of color to follow suit in an industry that had created a plethora of wealth for people that don't look like me." A firm engaged in finding value in MBS in a variety of structured products, Hollis Park capitalizes on securities that have different prepayment speeds. No conversation with a fixed income expert would be complete without an assessment of central banks. And on the Fed, Troy has much to say. Calling low interest rates an addictive drug, Troy sees no obvious path for the Fed to disengage from markets, expecting ongoing volatility linked to this codependency. Please enjoy this episode of the Alpha Exchange, my conversation with Troy Dixon. My guest today on the Alpha Exchange is Troy Dixon. He is the founder and CIO of Hollis Park, a firm that specializes in MBS and an array of structured products. Troy, thanks for joining us today on the podcast.
Excited to be on and looking forward to the conversation.
Well, it's great to reconnect with you after a number of years. You've been in the investment industry for quite some time now, and you've traded through episodes of vast crisis and also some really benign markets. So we'll have an opportunity to review the kind of comings and goings of the risk cycle. But why don't we start from the start? Why don't you tell us a little bit about the early days in your career? What sparked your initial interest in finance? Tell us about your start in the industry.
Yeah, so I went to a liberal arts school in Massachusetts by the name of Holy Cross and played football there. We were lucky enough to have sort of a mentorship programs that was set up. And the mentor that was given to me was an iBanker at Kidder Peabody. During one of my winter breaks, I came down and I spent some time with him. And he took me to the equity trading floor at Kidder at the time. This is in the very, very early 90s. And as soon as I walked on the trading floor, I recognized that this was the atmosphere that I wanted to be a part of. While investment banking was sort of a normal route for kids graduating school, at that time, being on a trading floor felt so much more at home. And after that point, I pursued it vehemently to make sure I got on a trading floor when I graduated.
What was it about the trading floor? Was it the energy, people stacked on top of each other? What was it about it?
Yeah, I think it lends itself to kind of people on top of each other, a team atmosphere. It reminded me a lot of like the athletics and the sports that I played in college and high school. And it kind of felt like a nice and natural transition from my life in college to using a lot of the skills, which were being a good team player, being a person that people enjoy being around, being really thoughtful, and then quite honestly, kind of liberal arts education, kind of being solution-based in our thinking. The things that I learned at Holy Cross I thought were immediately applicable to the day-to-day on a trading floor, regardless of what product I kind of ended up in.
You wound up hitting the street in the 90s. What firm and in terms of what initial product desk were you on?
So I started Salomon Brothers in the early 90s. And that program at the time was a rotational program, and then a group would choose you or they'd match you with a group. At the time, Salomon Brothers was sort of just coming off of the storied Liar's Poker era, and as a result, no trainee really wanted to even rotate there because they still had this lore of being very, very difficult on the trainees, and I was one of the few that wanted to actually go there. And it's sort of been my MO throughout my life, is I want to go and do things that other people don't want to do for whatever reason. So I spent a lot of time on the trading desk, even when I was supposed to be rotating other places. And finally, at the end of the placement, they put me as part of the past due trading group.
This is fascinating. You wind up at Salomon Brothers and specifically in mortgages. And of course, in the early 90s, I think it was 93, Merriweather and his team spin out to form LTCM. They recruit this all-star team of academics and professors, also some policy officials, guys like David Mullins from the Fed. And they launch this hedge fund that's got tremendous success early on, but ultimately, of course, we know the story. What was that period like in the mid-90s? I'm curious if you can share with us some of, whether it's the different risk events, including LTCM, that you wound up trading through. Give us some perspective on those early days.
John was, obviously, when I started, he was a folk hero, if you would, from that perspective. And much later in life, I've actually become friends with him and play golf with him. So that's a sort of another story. But the thing I think that I kind of learned, and we were their biggest counterparty in the mortgage portion of their business at the time. And one of the things that I love about markets is no matter how intelligent you are, and no matter how much firepower you can assume, the markets can sometimes be more irrational than you can stay solvent. And that was the lesson that I learned in 1994. 1995 was pretty evidently that while you can amass this massive arsenal that should weather any storm, the market is more powerful at times than you can even imagine. And I think that's what we learned from LTCM. And I still kind of use that as a mechanism for risk management, even in my head today, is don't get too brave. Don't be too smart. Because I think at some point when you think you're smarter than the markets is where trouble can amass. And so I always, as a result of those times, police myself pretty vehemently around making sure I don't get too far out above my skis, recognizing that, as I said earlier, the market can stay more irrational longer than I can stay solvent. And I want to be respectful of that potential storm.
Well, you certainly had a front row seat there. Certainly the 94, there was a big rate shock with Greenspan tightening and then LTCM, of course. So you're in the throes of it. What are the dislocations that you can recall that emerged during those periods? Were there things specifically in the mortgage market that still, as you look at them, you have an appreciation for just how big those moves were? What were the asset price moves?
Yeah, so it's interesting. Like today, we talk about, the market's gotten volatile in the last 2 or 3 weeks. And, you know, the mortgage basis of mortgages versus treasuries will move 5 ticks or 6 ticks. I remember at the time I was a younger guy on the desk, so I was responsible for trading overnight in Asia. And a customer comes to me and says, listen, I need you to bid. And this is in the midst of the LTCM crisis where literally every bid that was getting hit was next bid was lower. And so we've been told strictly, like, we can't buy any more securities. Level is irrelevant. So I was asked to bid, not a huge amount, but I was asked to bid some securities and I bid them. I said to the salesperson, I can't bid these. And he says, are you serious? Like, you've got to put a bid on it. That's inappropriate. I'm going to call tomorrow. I'm going to call your boss. So I felt obliged and said, well, listen, I'll put a level on it, but you're not going to like it. And I remember bidding the bonds and trying to go back to sleep because it's 3 o'clock in the morning or whatever it was. And the salesperson calls me back and says, you can own them there. And I remember distinctly my heart dropping in large part because I really had no idea you're kind of bidding these things in blind. And at the same time, I recognized that I had said this is the level that I was willing and being comfortable and being long them. And I said, fine, the trade's done. I immediately got up and went into the office. I hedged out some of the exposure in treasuries. And thankfully, by luck, mortgages caught a bid that day and I was able to get out and make a fair amount of money. But it was one of those things where I bid the bonds back a point and change. We're talking about big volatility when they move 3 or 4 ticks in today's day and age. And so it was just a very different dynamic around markets and the concept of volatility, particularly coming off of Volcker and things of that nature. And now where you have a very predictive Fed, they stay in their lane. They give you great guidance on what they're thinking and where they're going, intermeeting. And so they've done a fair amount of lowering of volatility vis-a-vis that. And you go back to the early 90s, and it was the complete opposite. And so those are the two sort of, I tell all the young traders that I deal with, I'm like, you have no idea about like what volatility looked like on a relative basis.
This is a great story about the risk-taking capacity that folks like you were in as market makers and the expectation that you'd be there to essentially satisfy either demand or supply from clients. I want you to take us through, let's say, past the internet bubble and into those days where the housing bubble was really starting to appreciate and all that securitization in the mortgage market, structured product market was built around housing. I mean, this was the era where banks, especially dealers, just got bigger and bigger in terms of their risk-bearing capacity. What was that period like in the kind of low vol era where the system just got bigger and bigger, people's books got bigger and bigger? I'm curious if you can just give us some perspective. You were at Deutsche Bank at the time. Is that correct?
When I think about the crisis, I think one of the big issues that created the crisis, particularly in the mortgage space, was the intense mark-to-market that started to happen between the dealer community. And so we look up and you say, okay, Lehman Brothers makes $1 billion in their mortgage business. Why do we only make $200 million? Merrill Lynch just started their originator and they make $700 million. How do we go about doing that, right? And as everybody dived into how did you do that, you started by creating the origination and owning the entire cycle. So you originate the loans, securitize the loans, and then position the loans and then sell the loans, hopefully. That was the business model for the Lehmans and the Bears and the large mortgage players at the time. And it's interesting because I went to Deutsche Bank in large part from UBS, in large part because Deutsche was making the commitment to kind of grow a substantial mortgage business, and in that by an originator. And so in the year that I got there, I was part of the executive committee and I was able to kind of be boots on the ground on us buying an originator. And we decided we weren't going to buy a subprime originator, but we were going to buy a sort of second tier originator in large part because the values that they traded at, and we could go in and re-underwrite their underwriting process to fit more with where we wanted to go. That was the thesis. And I say this to people, the difference between good traders and great traders is great traders take off bad trades faster. And so we closed on the originator in January of 2007. And they had massive pipes all over the country. They had multiple offices and things of that nature. By June, we began shutting down all the offices, recognizing that there was an issue that was brewing in a very, very sincere way. It's one of the things I'm more proud of in my career is being part of that team that said, this isn't going to work. We had a bad trade. We'll close in January. We spent $300 million on this originator. It's time to shut it down. And we shut down a bunch of offices. We rewrote the underwriting standards for all the loans that were coming onto our balance sheet. Now, you understand the pipelines on these things are 6, 8, 12 months. So when you shut down on June, this thing's still going to run for another year probably. And so we had to kind of deal with that. But I believe the difference between what happened at Deutsche Bank with regard to the mortgage business and what happened at, let's say, at Merrill Lynch was they let their subprime originator run for an additional 6 or 7 months, and that's all you needed. And so it was a very sort of hairpin turn, if you would, from how bad the cycle got. And I think I was part of a group of guys, a leadership team, that kind of quickly realized like this thing had done a 180. And the ramifications of it were cataclysmic, and we needed to do all the things we could to kind of get out or sort of lower exposure. And so it was a really difficult time for the better part of a year and a half to 2 years. But I think, again, I'm proud of that period because I feel like the fact that we were willing to sort of take our lumps on a trade that we had just done was sort of a pretty big difference maker that I don't think many people would capture in sort of Deutsche Bank history.
Well, you mentioned closing on this originator in Jan 07. The VIX closed at below 10 in Jan 07. And I'm just wondering if you, and of course, the corollary to the VIX could be Morgan Stanley CDS trading at 20-ish basis points around right about the same time. I'm wondering if you could just think out loud. I'd love to hear you think out loud about that. To me, it's a fascinating sort of coexistence where you've got this almost tidal wave of risk that's building and kind of set to come. And yet you have some of the lowest recorded levels of risk premium we've ever seen at the same time. How does it get to be that way, where there's that inconsistency?
Yeah, because I think the volatility, kind of like a virus, if you would, and excuse the pun, it starts in a small space at a small time. It builds and festers in that space. That space figures out quickly kind of how bad it is, but probably don't really have the full gravitas of what's really going on. And as a result, it just takes a fair amount of time for it to filter to other markets, or at least at that period. And so I say to people, it took a lot of time for people in the mortgage market who mid-2007, people kind of knew the cat was out of the bag. And people were now at the point where they were just hope hedging, hope things get better, hope that the people start to pay their mortgages, things of that nature. And it was just kind of brewing in the market from mid-07 to when sort of things got really bad towards the end of 08. But I said this to one of my investors just recently. The velocity for which things move now is so much faster. The great financial crisis was probably soup to nuts, a 1.5 to 2 year sort of experiment, depending on kind of when it hit you. 2020s lasted 25, 30 days. From that perspective, once the treasury market freezed up, the world said, oh my God. And literally it became pear-shaped almost instantaneously. And thankfully, the Fed had the poles in the ground from an infrastructure standpoint to go and purchase treasuries and purchase agency mortgages and have the facility to talk about buying credit to lower volatility almost immediately. And that's why people, oh, well, things got to a great price in late March, early April, and then they were purchased. No, that wasn't the answer. The answer was that the federal government, the Federal Reserve said, we're going to buy everything. And so as long as you trust in the U.S. government, you can sort of calm yourself around your asset that you own, and we're going to be supportive of it. So I think as a result, credit, in our opinion, has changed dramatically as a result of this last iteration. Because even if you go back to the great financial crisis, the Fed never actually said we're going to buy credit. They used other products to lower volatility to force credit back tighter. So they bought agency mortgages, they bought treasuries, and this is the first time in the history of the Fed in 2008, 2009 that they bought agency mortgages. And that was effectively the canary in the coal mine for lowering overall volatility, because obviously they have this thing called negative convexity. And so it was an exacerbating vol, at least fixed income vol, and volatilities when they get going are pretty linear. And so they had this scenario where they could sort of police it vis-a-vis agency mortgages. This crisis in March of this year was too widespread. The virus had gotten so far that they had to do things that historically nobody thought that they could do or would ever do, which was commit to buying sort of credit product on the Fed's balance sheet. But I think it speaks in volumes of how quickly they were able to recognize how bad the situation was. And even as we sit here today, if the Fed was to say we're no longer buying treasuries and or mortgages, volatility would explode again. We're not in anywhere near of a safe place. It's still government-led. And I personally think that you're going to have a Fed that is involved in overall markets in a very sort of dramatic way for the next decade for various reasons. But I really do feel like if you go back to 08, 09, when the Fed started buying agency mortgages, we said, oh, they'll buy them for 6 months. In 2019, they were still the biggest holder and the biggest player in the agency mortgage market. So 11 years later, they were still the biggest player and the biggest holder of agency mortgages. So this whole concept that they'll sort of back away in 6 or 8 months, I just don't think makes a ton of sense. And historically, that hasn't been the case.
Obviously, the virus is a terrible thing that's impacted the world. But as you note, in some ways, the precursor of the financial crisis and all the work that went into trying to stave it off and the programs that were built, it's in some ways lucky we had that before the pandemic. The speed with which they flipped the switch on a lot of those programs was impressive. I remember from the GFC, the VIX stayed above 30 for, I think it was about 9 months. And this was just much faster reversion backwards, lower in risk premium levels. I wanted to go back to the financial crisis again, because inside Deutsche Bank, you're running a large book and a large team, and you have a combination of prop risk, a lot of prop risk, I'm sure. And also you have, as you alluded to earlier during your days at Salomon Brothers, you guys are a market maker. You're there for your customers. If you can recall, that just the balancing act of being there as a liquidity provider to your customer base, but also trying to manage what I'm sure was a pretty wicked set of Greeks and risks on your own book. What's that balancing act like during a period of such elevated volatility?
It was very, very difficult. And I think what you had to do and what we tried to do was say, okay, here are the sectors where we can be relevant for our account base. And let's just be very straightforward and direct with them saying, okay, of the 25 things that we used to be able to provide you liquidity and or markets on, we're going to have to lower that to 15 things. And we're going to try to do our best on those 15 things. On the other things, just given where we are from a risk perspective, and at the time we were very restricted by VAR and VAR models around certain things. So there were certain assets, given where the bank was, that were just sort of third rail events. And so we tried to just make sure that the things that weren't third rail events, we kept our footprint, we kept our composure, and we continued to sort of provide the liquidity where we could. In the interim, try to obviously make money in those areas in a pronounced way. And so that was sort of the dynamic that was going on there. Was once we got into the heart of the crisis, late 2008, earlier 2009, risk management sort of became much more relevant than, hey, being a liquidity provider. And they obviously, the risk management group, garnered a fair amount of power in how things were going to proceed on a go-forward basis. And you had to adhere to that. And so you tried to be thoughtful around these new ground rules that were given to you and how you were going to sort of play it within those ground rules, but make sure you continued to be thoughtful about the relationships that you had built on the buy side.
You managed through that seismic risk event, not even an event, but as you said, roughly almost a two-year period, and remained at Deutsche Bank through 2013, and you founded Hollis Park. Walk us through you back then as you sought to strike out and launch a fund. What was on your mind in terms of the product that you would deliver to your investors? Tell us about how you thought about creating your firm.
I think when you, and you know this, Dean, and sort of launch your own thing, it has to be somewhat of a labor of love. It has to be something that you've kind of always wanted to do or aspired to do, because the heavy lift of kind of going out on your own and launching something or doing something, I don't care if it's a hedge fund or it's a grocery store, that is a different dynamic that not everybody is built for. So I start there instead of saying I've always wanted to do it. It was something that was relevant to me. Two, as I looked at the hedge fund landscape and I said, okay, who looks like me that I can aspire to from the standpoint of launching a fund? And I said, there really are no African Americans that run sizable hedge funds. And so that was also part of the thought process for me is, wow, wouldn't it be good to do well and do good at the same time and create a path for others to follow? And that was an exciting driving portion of why I wanted to do it. I think the things I learned at Deutsche Bank were also very relevant to thinking about the investment strategy. Because I say to everybody that wants to launch their own fund, I say, what is unique about what you're putting together? If you don't have a unique spin to whatever it is you're doing, it's going to be extremely difficult to garner investors. It just is, particularly if you're trying to be institutional. The lessons that I learned at Deutsche Bank in running, and basically I acquired the non-agency business in mid-2009, and I had the agency business for that period up until then in total. As we walked through it, the one thing that I recognized is that while we were struggling mightily in the credit portion of the business, the agency portion of our business was actually making its biggest strides with regard to revenue. And as I sort of took a step back and kind of went into the Greeks, it sort of makes sense. When you have true alpha product, it should perform well in high volatility mechanisms. And when you have true beta product, it should underperform in high volatility scenarios. And so it kind of gave me the idea around, how do I create a durable portfolio that is sort of all weather within the structured product universe? And what I came to was, let's split the portfolio into alpha and beta. Let's overhang it with what liquidity looks like through stress periods. And then what yield bogey we're trying to assume for our investor. And through that mechanism, you can create a portfolio that if volatility spikes and you underperform in the beta portion of your book, but you have it sized correctly, you can make up for that and then some in the alpha portion of your book. Or if you have a scenario where volatility like 2018 for the first 10 months basically ran at its all-time lows, well, if you have enough beta that's just clipping its coupon, that's a win for you. And so structuring the portfolio around that is the idea that I had kind of garnered from Deutsche Bank, and I sort of used that as what was special and unique about Hollis Park when we first launched.
I was going to read a quote back to you. It's your own words, but it's an article I saw that was written about you and the founding of your firm. You said, "I was naive about a lot of things, but the core thesis of it was to lay the framework for people of color to follow suit," which is really commendable. 2014's a long time ago. So much has happened. I think, as you alluded to just before, we're all under the heavy thumb of central banks, and no thumb is heavier than the Fed's. So 2014, they're sort of in that long stretch of QE. 2013, Bernanke first uttered the word taper, so that kind of became a thing. Took a while for Janet Yellen to get off zero. I think that was late 2015 was the first 25 bips. So it's been a long cycle of involvement by the Fed. What did they get up to? 2.5% was the peak in the funds rate or something thereabouts. As you sort of look back from 2014 to now, I was hoping you could share with us just some of the either risk events or cycles of risk that have been meaningful in terms of where you've set up trades that have been successful or where your risk management process has really kicked in. Nothing more seismic than 2020, of course, but what are some of the sub-events?
One of the things that you have to recognize is that these vol events have all been relatively short-lived since 2014, and that's in large part because, and we can say the Fed, but the central banks in general have decided part of their mandate, which I don't think it is, but thankfully in some cases it has been, is to lower volatility until they feel like the economies are healthy enough to actually deal with the volatility. And so what we've seen 2014 to 2020 is central banks being much more protective of not allowing volatility to run for long periods of time. And so you go back to 2018 as a perfect example. 2018, we were low vol the entire year, until our federal chairperson said, "I really want to raise interest rates." And I say to people, low interest rates is a powerful drug. And to get our economy or the global economy off of this powerful drug is going to take some glass breaking. And I just don't think anybody has the stomach for the glass to break. So as a result, you had this Fed chairperson who in October had a very different lingo. And that's what set off sort of the unwind of risk and the unwind in the equity market and the rally in the bond market and basically a seizure of credit. And until he sort of did his 160, 165 on his way to 180, that's what calmed markets. And so we're in this scenario, and I think it's the next decade, where the Federal Reserve / central banks across the globe will dictate how things go. And the one worry you have, and this is the cataclysmic one, is at some point do we say, we don't trust you anymore. Your balance sheet is entirely too big, your leverage, and if you were a company, we would challenge your company. That's the worry. I don't think we're at that. Hopefully we never get to that point, but that's the real sort of break point. If we don't get there, it's fine. We'll kind of plod along. And could we beat Japan in theory? Yes. Is that the worst case scenario? No, considering the other optic is what was 2.5 to 3 weeks in March of 2020, I think was a wake-up call to a lot of people. With regard to kind of risk, I mean, I think the world's evolving. Over the last 6 years, we've seen this huge technology boom that has affected literally every single market, whether you're talking about the equity market and the vol market that you sort of focus on, or you talk about the mortgage market that I focus on, or whether you talk about the treasury market, the like global rates markets that global macro funds look at. All of it has been affected in some way, shape, and form by technology. And so what we've tried to do is sort of say, okay, how can we take the concept of technology and the movement of technology and apply it to our investment thesis in agency mortgages, for instance? And so you wanted me to tell you a scenario of sort of a win. a big portion of our book is in the agency mortgage space. And in the start of 2019, one of the things that kind of, and it goes back to this technology scenario, was refinancing your home was incredibly antiquated relative to where technology is. You still had to go out and get an appraisal, and you had to sign 56 docs, and you had to provide your pay stub and your tax return, or copies of your tax returns, all of these things to refinance. And one of the things that we identified is that through firms like Quicken and PennyMac, they were breaking down those technology barriers to create alpha for themselves. And they were going to make the process of refinancing your home significantly easier vis-a-vis using technology. What we saw was in 2019, the models were using Brexit and the time of Brexit as the estimations around where prepays would go and mortgages. And what we recognized at Hollis Park is that was fool's gold, because technology had changed so dramatically from Brexit to the beginning of 2019, which isn't a long period of time, but still had changed significantly, that refinancings and refis were going to be significantly faster than the models were predicting. And so we put on a bunch of exposures that were set up to take advantage of this sort of technology boom slash faster prepay scenario. And in 2019, we saw prepay at the fastest level we've ever seen in the history of the mortgage market. And a big portion of that was obviously low interest rates, but the sort of unforeseen portion of it was the technology portion of it, where people were getting their appraisals online. So you go, you know, somebody goes online and says, okay, these five houses sold, here's the value of your home. You don't have to wait for a survey to come to your home. There's the value. And so all these things sort of were really relevant with regard to prepays. And so we try to do things like that to kind of create alpha, because we are in an evolving scenario. We're at all-time low interest rates. We're at untethered sort of structural flatness of the yield curve. Like all these different things that are new and nuanced to the markets, there are going to be repercussions to it. And we try to get out in front of it and use the mortgage market, which is where our expertise are, as a notion around these sort of broader ideas.
So interesting on the prepayment model, the speeds increasing as a function of technology. Really interesting. In general, and you've spent probably your career really thinking a lot about prepayment speeds and so forth. And I'm wondering, as this technology has become available to folks and the realization of higher speeds has occurred, is the market now shifting in terms of how it prices these things on a going forward basis? In other words, was 2019 almost an event for the market to realize what you realized? And is it sort of priced faster going forward?
No. I mean, I think models, and you have to understand, the mortgage market fancies itself super quantitative, and it is, but there's also this people element to it. That's the hardest part for these models to predict. And so when you kind of look at term structure interest rate model, and then you apply it on some sort of refinance or prepayment model, that's how you get to your estimations. From a term structure interest rate scenario, we're at untethered space. So it's almost like we don't even know. We have no historical reference to where interest rates were 60 basis points on the 10-year note for a prolonged period of time. We don't have any historical data, and all these models are regression models because that's how models work. You couple that with the fact that historical prepays have been predicated on the Citibanks and Bank of America's servicing your loan. And then after the great financial crisis, where they were hit with massive fines, they decided that's not a business that they really want to do anymore. And the Quickens, the PennyMacs of the world now take over that, and their business models are completely different. They want to refinance every single human being. Whereas Bank of America has your home mortgage, your car loan. They probably own the loan on the books, so they don't even go out and get a Freddie or Fannie wrapper. So they're not calling you every day to refinance your home because it's not necessarily a positive P&L event for them. And so the world's changing, and these models continually are struggling to be predictive of it because it isn't necessarily term structure modeling. It isn't a term structure prepay scenario. It is about how are individuals reacting to technology? How are individuals reacting to change of vanguard in certain sort of portions of the agency mortgage market, and what are going to be the reactions. That lends itself very well to kind of what we do here at Hollis Park, because that's what we pride ourselves on over the last 6 years, is being really good at identifying when those sort of those satanic shifts are going to happen in the space. And, you know, we've been okay at it so far.
You mentioned Fannie and Freddie, and of course, these guys have been huge players in the markets. I would love for you to see if you can provide a big picture overview of how they interact with the price of optionality, the price of maybe the supply and demand for options in the rates market. I know that at least some portion of Biden winning throws into some question some of the reforms that were to be pursued. How, at this point in time, 12 years post-crisis, are the GSEs interacting with the pricing of securities that you focus on so much?
I mean, their footprint's significantly smaller than it was historically. They historically have been the delta hedger, i.e. you own a mortgage, you're short the convexity, and so when the market goes down, you're getting longer, when the market goes up, you're getting shorter, and they're sort of delta hedging that. That's completely changed in the new Vanguard. For all intents and purposes, they're willing to just deal with the duration drift, in large part because they're effectively under the guise of the government. And it's the same thing with the Fed and their portfolio, right? The Fed now owns, whatever it is, $1.8 trillion of the $7 trillion agency mortgage market. And they bought them on their books, and they don't care. They're just going to own them and watch them pay down over a 20-year period. And so as a result, they're not delta hedging any of the exposure either. So 10-year note goes back to 3%, which in theory should extend the duration of their portfolio pretty dramatically. You're not going to see a selling of duration. And so that's had a really sort of forceful lowering of volatility in the rate space in general, and then the mortgage space most specifically. And that's not going to change because the two agencies are effectively back to close to where they're at their caps. The government's going to continue to use them in things like forbearance and sort of to help people stay in their homes, because we don't really know the knock-on effects of the COVID crisis on our economy. And while we have vaccinations that are forward-looking, the knock-on effects to people in their homes in middle America is still very, very uncertain. So the government's going to need Freddie and Fannie as the buffer or as the processor of keeping people in their homes through things like forbearance, where the government effectively gives you interest rate loans. So, long-winded way of saying, I think they're going to continue in their current sort of status, regardless of who the president is, in the scenario of being a mechanism to keep volatility low, being a mechanism to keep homeowners in their home, because we all recognize how important home ownership and home valuation is to our overall GDP. So they're going to be used in that mechanism. And I think they're going to have very little to do with actual pushing and trending markets in the short term.
Throughout our conversation, we've talked a lot about the Fed, and it's sometimes very direct interventions in the market. Sometimes it's impact on volatility. So they clearly did a ton in 2020. The government's also done a lot, providing income support to so many of the people that have been so affected by the pandemic. I'm curious just on things like asset-backed securities tied to consumer debt. How much of, as you evaluate structures like that, are you evaluating the potential government response on a going forward basis? There's talk about a either big stimulus or a mini stimulus. How does the fiscal side now figure into how you guys underwrite risk?
One of the things that we've kind of been telling all of our investors is credit's not credit any longer. Credit used to be, send me your tax returns, send me your balance sheet, let me assess your assets and your liabilities, let me see how much cash you have on board, let me now look at the structure of where your security actually sits and see where I want to own on the cap structure. That used to be credit. Credit's no longer that. Credit is, okay, where does this sit in the bailiwick of an industry or product set that the government will support? If it's high on that metric, that gives me a lot more comfort in owning the security, even at tighter yields. And if it's not, then the investment strategy is a little different, because you don't have the net underneath you to protect you, which is central banks. And that can come central banks and or monetary policy. So it's the first time in the history we've had our Fed chairperson talk about fiscal and the importance of fiscal. because he recognizes that the economy is on a string and there's only so much that monetary policy can do. We do need fiscal stimulus and we need fiscal help. And so from our perspective, what we try to do is play in the sectors where there's some uncertainty around where the government's going to be. And so one of those spaces is retail and office space. And you talked about asset-backed securities, but you know where we've been focused is office buildings, footprints in office buildings. What does that look like on a go-forward basis with the advent of Zoom? How many people do you actually need in your office? How much real estate do you actually need? We just built a whole city on the west side of Manhattan, and now 50 to 60% of all your workers don't want to come into the office anymore, even when we get a vaccine. And so there's all these things that are going to be uncertain around these asset-backed type securities or securities that are backed by cash flows from either retail and or office space. And you're going to see a wide array of sort of valuations as a result. And I think it's one of those spaces where credit managers can add real alpha to processes due to that underwriting. And this is why this crisis is very, very different than 08-09. In 08-09, it was a scenario where close your eyes, buy any asset, and we look up in 9 months, 10 months, a year, and it's going to be up 20, 30, 40%. This is very different. There are going to be assets that get paid off at par that are trading at 60 today, and there are bonds that are trading at 60 today that will go to workout. And that binary response in a space where it's really hard to understand how the government is going to be the protective mechanism is where we think there's still a fair amount of juice. So owning double A's off of a CLO, those are money good. The government's going to do enough to make sure that those don't, you know, if a double A doesn't pay, then there's a bigger issue in the overall broader market. It's going to be a little less protective. But when you get down the cap structure and you're a qualified investor, it's going to be hard to understand how the government saves qualified investors. And so we try to focus in that area because that's where the uncertainty will lie, not just for the next 6 months or 8 months until we get a vaccine. That's where the uncertainty will lie for the next 3 to 4 years as we understand what technology and the fast forward of technology vis-a-vis COVID has done to sort of various markets and structured products.
As you note, the economy and the speed with which technology is imposing itself, probably for the force of good, but certainly creating dislocations in certain industries in the medium term. If you were to think about a broader set of risks, maybe not a banking-wide systemic risk, but a more macro consideration that you and your team are actively considering as we start 2021. We spent a lot of time talking about episodes of crisis. What does 2021 look like to you in terms of where there might be vulnerabilities that are worthy of consideration and potentially guarding against?
The government support or the concept of government support has given people a false sense of safety. And we think the knock-on effects of COVID, not to mention prior to COVID, it wasn't like we had this sort of, we were 2.5% inflation. We were like struggling to kind of we had massive productivity issues. We had all these different things, lack of people coming back to the workforce. I mean, there was just all these things that were headwinds to sort of creating real growth before COVID. And then you couple that within COVID. And we've done some things to placate the issues vis-a-vis, you know, the consumer is in good shape because they've gotten their money and they've done a decent job. So like from that perspective, but how long are they in good shape? How long can this economy go without real productivity, without sort of real inflation building? And that's the question I think you have to ask yourself. And like, how long will that take to play out? And so we have gone, in, at least in our credit book, we've gone a bunch to cash because we are worried that like people have a false sense of safety and the government, the Fed, can't save everybody. And at some level, the knock-on effects of COVID, even with the vaccination, I think are going to be more detrimental than I think people are anticipating. And as a result, we ourselves have said we're going to take a defensive stance, at least in credit. And so that's what we're thinking about in credit. In the agency side of our book, we're like, this is going to be great because prepays are going to stay at historical fast levels. And so relative value prepay strategies should perform well because you should be able to source assets that are going to prepay slower and hedge them with prepays, assets that are going to prepay fast and take out the carry. And we're going to be at low interest rates for the foreseeable future. And as a result, this sort of refi machine that's helping to stabilize the economy, quite honestly, needs to stay in place. And so even if you say you're one of these people that says, well, given everything that's going on in the economy and where we are, we should be at a 2.5% 10-year note. You may be right fundamentally, but structurally we can't get there because ultimately if we were to go there, the economy would start to falter again. And so again, it goes back to my statement earlier. I think low rates are an addictive drug, and I think our economy is very, very addicted, and it's going to be hard to get away from that. And so as a result, our agency business should prosper. It's had a good year this year, and it should continue to sort of do well on a go-forward basis in 2021. So that's kind of how we separate the two.
Troy, this has been an excellent conversation. Really appreciate you taking the time to be a guest. Our listeners will absolutely value the insights. So thanks again.
Thank you very much for having me. It's been a pleasure.
You've been listening to the Alpha Exchange. If you've enjoyed the show, please do tell a friend. And before we leave, I wanted to invite you to drop us some feedback. As we aim to utilize these conversations to contribute to the investment community's understanding of risk, your input is valuable and provides direction on where we should focus. Please email us at feedback@alphaexchangepodcast.com. Thanks again, and catch you next time.